The Visitor Services staff of Togiak Refuge recently held its annual planning meeting, a get-together of not just the Dillingham-based staff members, but also our esteemed colleagues from Togiak and Quinnahock, Pete Abraham, Kimiel Kenrood, and John Mark. There's a whole lot of stuff that gets hashed out over the course of what's normally 2 or 3 days, including the direction of several annual programs and projects, training needs, and budgetary items. You know, you get 7 or 8 people spread out over an area the size of both Rhode Island and Connecticut combined, and there are bound to be all sorts of logistics to be hashed out. Not every topic is pertinent to every individual in the group, though for most of us there's usually a fair amount of overlap. For example, there might be things they have going on that I do not have a direct hand with, but I am able to help out in a support sort of way, such as creating materials that they can use in the execution of whatever project they might have going on. I share that because 2 things got me to thinking about this week's topic. One is that it's a small part of a large project that's been put on my plate and it's gaining some steam, and that is me becoming a certified Hunter's Ed instructor. Fact is, I have been up at Elecnagik School, helping to lead their students through the course this week, which will conclude with a range day here at Dillingham today. Also, a number of the items discussed during our planning meeting were viewed through the lens of the financial support of those items. That got me to thinking about something with connection to both funding and Hunter's Ed, the Federal Aid in Wildlife Restoration Act, most often referred to as the Pittman-Robertson Act. Welcome to Bristol Bay Field Notes. I'm Terry Fuller, Education Specialist for Togiak National Wildlife Refuge. On the heels of a national and statewide election, there's no need to fret about what this particular piece of legislation would or will mean going forward. It's been in place since 1937 and is still going very strong today. There are any number of types of legislations that have an impact on our lives on a daily basis. Many are very under the radar, while some are a bit more contentious or high profile. A few live for a while and then get kicked to the curb. An example of one that's high profile? How about the Affordable Care Act? Some like it, some do not. It is not my place to share my opinions on here about it, or rather, this is the wrong forum for my opinions about it. I merely hold it up as an example of a piece of legislation upon which not everyone is in agreement. Not so with Pittman-Robertson. Perhaps there's a few folks out there that don't care for it, but far more people recognize the good it does. Also, perhaps the fact that it's been in place for nearly 80 years has it to where folks just don't think about it much or possibly don't even know about it at all. In a way, it's very under the radar. First of all, let's talk about what it is and how it came about. Again, the official name is the Federal Aid in Wildlife Restoration Act of 1937, named for what it does and the year it came into being. However, it's most often referred to as the Pittman-Robertson Act for its sponsors, Nevada Senator Key Pittman and Virginia Congressman Absalom Willis Robertson. It was signed by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt on September 2, 1937, and became effective on July 1 of the following year, and it has been amended a number of times through the years, with the last change coming in 2000. In the late 1800s and early 1900s, prior to the creation of this act, many species of wildlife had been driven to or near extinction by commercial, market hunting pressure, and/or habitat degradation from humans. I have mentioned this before when I've talked about the role that plume hunters played in the creation of the National Wildlife Refuge System. The Pittman-Robertson Act took over an excise tax to provide funds to each state to manage such animal species and their habitats. Notable species that have not only bounced back but simply thrive today since the implementation of this act include the white-tailed deer, kind of hard to believe, right? Wild turkey, and wood ducks. Back in 1937, the country was wallowing through the Great Depression, if you'll recall from your history books and classes. Conservation was badly in need of funding, as were most other things. Hunters and other folks associated with various types of shooting sports lobbied for Congress to take an existing 11% excise tax on firearms and ammunition that, at the time, went to the Department of Treasury and to divert the funds to state fish and wildlife agencies. For its part, Congress at the time wanted to simply repeal the tax entirely. It often starts with one person, doesn't it? In this case, it was Carl Shoemaker, a former director of the Oregon Fish and Game Commission. He was a leading proponent of the idea to move the existing 11% in an effort to pump financial life into conservation efforts. Shoemaker drafted the legislation and enlisted the help of Pittman, who introduced the bill. To gain House support, Shoemaker met with Robertson. During a visit over lunch in the Senate dining room, Robertson took the draft he had been given and added 29 words. Those 29 words read, "and which shall include a prohibition against the diversion of license fees paid by hunters for any other purpose than the administration of said state fish and game departments." In other words, this small addition of words have kept these monies going directly to where they were most needed and not siphoned off for other purposes. The concept is pretty simple. In a nutshell, every time you buy a new rifle, handgun, shotgun, bow, arrows, or ammunition, 11% of that sale goes to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, where the funds are redistributed back to the state fish and wildlife agencies for conservation efforts. Broken down a bit, it works as follows. The excise tax is set at 11% of the wholesale price for long guns and ammunition, and 10% of the wholesale price for handguns. This tax applies to basically all commercial sales and imports, irrespective of whether the intended purpose is shooting, hunting, or personal home defense, and it's paid by manufacturers, producers, and importers. The tax is currently administered by the Alcohol and Tobacco Tax and Trade Bureau, which then turns the funds over to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The service then deposits the monies into a special account called the Wildlife Restoration Trust Fund, which is administered by the service. These funds are made available to states and territories the year following their collection. The distribution of the funds is set by a formula. First, $8 million is used for enhanced hunter education programs, including the construction or maintenance of public target ranges. Next, $3 million is set aside for projects that require cooperation amongst the states. Third, one half of the excise tax collected on handguns is set aside for basic hunter education programs. In most cases, the states must match at least 25% of a project's cost. The remainder of the trust fund is then divided in half, with 50% allocated in proportion to the area of the state and 50% in proportion to the number of paid hunting licenses in the state relative to paid hunting licenses in the entire country. There are accountability measures in place. States must fulfill certain requirements to use the money apportioned to them. None of the money from their hunting license sales may be used by anyone other than the state's Fish and Game Department. Plans for what to do with the money must be submitted to and approved by the Secretary of Interior. Some of the many acceptable, common options include research, surveys, and management of wildlife and habitat, and the acquisition or lease of land, amongst other things. Once a plan has been approved, the state pays and is reimbursed up to 75% of that cost through Pittman-Robertson funds. The 25% for which the state is on the hook generally comes from hunting license sales. If, for whatever reason, any of the federal money does not get spent, after 2 years, that money is reallocated to the Migratory Bird Conservation Act. I mentioned that there have been amendments. A number of those happened in the 1970s. One example is an amendment that created a 10% tax on handguns and their ammunition and an 11% tax on archery equipment. A part of that particular amendment also spelled out how those monies are to be used. It mandated that half of the money from each of those new taxes must be used to educate and train hunters through the creation and upkeep of hunter safety classes and shooting and target ranges. This piece of legislation has been incredibly effective in doing what it was created to do. The act creates a direct link between those that hunt or participate in the shooting sports and the resources needed to expand and enhance opportunities to hunt and shoot. Since its beginning, over $10 billion have been collected from manufacturers and awarded to states, making the firearms and ammunition industry America's largest contributor to conservation and success. As mentioned, it's played a mighty big role in the procurement and maintenance of wildlife habitat and the restoration and strengthening of a number of wildlife species. And it continues to fund very worthwhile projects, like hunters' education, for which I'm sure the students of Alecnagik would be happy to say thank you. So the next time you purchase a hunting license or buy a new gun, keep in mind that you're playing a part in keeping hunting and conservation in our country moving forward in a very positive way. For Field Notes, I'm Terry Fuller. Music from Loon Echo Lake provided courtesy of Solitudes at www.solitudes.com.
Thank you.